From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Why does the Bush administration hate international justice so much that it's willing to declare war on a NATO ally?
The Hague Invasion Act. President Bush signs a new law designed to intimidate countries that ratify the treaty for the International Criminal Court. And the expansion of FBI powers during the so-called War on Terror. Today we'll look at the case of Leonard Peltier.
That the FBI actually sponsored terrorism within the United States in order to suppress a political movement, the American Indian movement.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The UN General Assembly last night condemned attacks against Palestinian and Israeli civilians and demanded an immediate end to Israeli incursions in the West Bank and all acts of violence, incitement, and destruction. The resolution was significantly watered down from the original Palestinian draft, which called for condemnation of Israeli atrocities and, quote, appropriate action against perpetrators of war crimes. The resolution was approved 114-4 at the end of a day-long debate in which Israel's occupation and recent reoccupation of West Bank cities was denounced by many countries in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. It got the support of the European Union, which played a key role in instigating the changes, but not the United States, Israel, Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands. This comes as Israeli helicopters fired missiles at what Palestinians say was a car parts factory, the Israeli military says was a bomb factory in Gaza late yesterday, injuring at least 4 people and damaging 3 buildings. It was the first airstrike against Gaza since July 22nd, when a one-ton bomb dropped by an F-16 killed 15 Palestinians, including 9 children. Earlier this week, Israeli troops demolished 9 homes of people accused of being terrorists. Human rights groups say house demolitions constitute collective punishment and violate international law. Meanwhile, Israel banned all travel by Palestinians on the West Bank. This, according to the Wall Street Journal today, President Bush received a briefing yesterday evening on the outlines of a new war plan for invading Iraq that would require significantly fewer troops than the 250,000 that military planners had previously proposed. This, according to a Pentagon official involved in war planning. General Tommy Franks, top commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East and Central Asia, has briefed President Bush at least twice before on concepts for deposing Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, defense officials have said. General Franks suggested both times that a massive invasion involving as many as 250,000 U.S. troops and a 3-month buildup would be necessary. Yesterday's briefing, however, hewed closer to plan that is gaining currency among senior Bush administration officials involving 50 to 80,000 troops backed by heavy air power. Again, this according to a Pentagon official in the Wall Street Journal. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan warned yesterday against any military assault on Iraq while violence rages between Israel and the Palestinians. He said, quote, it would be unwise to attack Iraq given the current circumstances of what's happening in the Middle East. This came as Annan said he was reexamining Iraq's invitation to Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix to visit Baghdad for technical talks. The U.S. has opposed any talks with Iraq. Still, Annan said he planned to send a letter to Baghdad today. This also comes as U.S. warplanes bombed Iraq again yesterday in the south of the country. No information on deaths or injuries is available. Global opposition to a massive attack against Iraq is growing. New polls in Britain say that more than half of Britons are against an attack. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder and his Social Democratic Party yesterday broke ranks with America's other European allies by declaring at the start of their election campaign that Germany would refuse to provide troops or money for an invasion of Iraq. Schroeder said Germany was ready to stay out, even if the UN gave its blessing to a war. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting that the U.S. seeks to secure maximum coordination with Israel in any American attack against Iraq. The paper says the U.S. will give Israel prior notice of any planned attack. The U.S. notified Ariel Sharon 60 hours before it launched the attack on Afghanistan last year, but Israel said it expects much longer warning before any American operation in Iraq. This from the Washington Post, a briefing given last month to a top Pentagon advisory board, described Saudi Arabia as an enemy of the United States and recommended that U.S. officials give it an ultimatum to stop backing terrorism or face seizure of its oil fields and its financial assets invested in the United States. The briefing said, quote, "The Saudis are active at every level of the terror chain, from planners to financiers, from cadre to foot soldier, from ideologist to cheerleader." The briefing was presented on July 10th to the Defense Policy Board, a group made up largely of former senior officials that advises the Pentagon on defense policy. The report said, quote, "Saudi Arabia supports our enemies and attacks our allies." A talking point attached to the last of 24 briefing slides went even further, describing Saudi Arabia as, quote, "the kernel of evil, the prime mover, the most dangerous opponent in the Middle East." Saudi Arabia has said it would not allow the U.S. to operate from its soil during a massive attack on Iraq. The U.S. is now shifting its operations to the Gulf state of Qatar. The FBI, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and three other U.S. Justice Department law enforcement agencies had at least 775 weapons and 400 laptops, computers stolen, lost, or missing over a recent two-year period. This according to a new report. The report said the INS had 539 missing weapons, while the FBI had 212 missing weapons in a two-year audit period. The FBI had an additional 211 weapons reported missing during a time period not covered by the audit. According to the report, local police recovered at least 18 of the missing weapons in connection with investigations into such crimes as robberies and drug dealing. For example, local police recovered a handgun stolen from an FBI agent's residence in New Orleans from the pocket of a murder victim. Police in Atlanta recovered a stolen DEA weapon during a narcotics search at a suspect's residence, while police in Philadelphia and in Tampa, Florida, recovered INS weapons used to commit armed robberies.
You're out on the ocean, and you get pulled down, free fall to the bottom. Like when you're drowning or falling asleep, you get turned around. And when you think you're swimming to the surface, you're swimming.
Free fall, Laurie Anderson, here on Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. On Friday, President Bush signed into law the American Service Members Protection Act of 2002, which will supposedly protect U.S. service members from the International Criminal Court. The new law authorizes the use of military force to liberate any American or citizen of a U.S. allied country being held by the court. This provision, dubbed the Hague Invasion Clause, has caused a strong reaction from U.S. allies around the world, particularly in the Netherlands. The law also provides for the withdrawal of U.S. military assistance from countries ratifying the ICC Treaty, the International Criminal Court Treaty, and restricts U.S. participation in U.N. peacekeeping unless the United States obtains immunity from prosecution. At the same time, these provisions can be waived by the president on national interest grounds. We're joined now by Ken Roth. He is director, executive director of Human Rights Watch. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to be here, Amy.
Well, the U.S. will invade a country that takes into custody a U.S. service member or U.S. official?
Amazing as it is, this act of Congress has authorized the president to use all necessary means, which is a reference to military force, to liberate any U.S. service member who might be arrested or detained by the International Criminal Court. And since the court is going to be based in The Hague in the Netherlands, a close NATO ally, this in essence allows the United States to engage in an act of war, to declare war against a fellow NATO ally. It's an amazing act.
How did it happen?
Well, this reflects the depth of animosity toward international justice by, on the one hand, the Bush administration, and on the other hand, the right-wing extreme within Congress, which pushed this through. The Bush administration has a view that international justice is for other people, that the United States, as the world's superpower, should be above being accountable to any international mechanism in its compliance with the most basic laws, the laws against genocide, war crimes, or crimes against humanity. And this act is a natural extension of that philosophy.
The U.S. will invade.
Well, it doesn't require the U.S. to invade. In fact, one of the things that's odd about this act is while it does show the depth of animosity toward the court, it also is filled with loopholes. And in fact, it's more a show than it is a reality. For example, you know, as you noted, it prohibits U.S. cooperation with the court, except, and then there's a huge exception, which is to say if the United States wants to pursue Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden or any other war criminal, in other words, anybody who the court might be going after, then it can cooperate.
But if it decides to go after Henry Kissinger, that's another story.
Well, obviously, it's free not to cooperate, too, but it could have not cooperated anyhow. So in that sense, the prohibition on cooperation is a prohibition with a huge loophole. Similarly, the prohibition on giving aid to non-NATO allies who might ratify the International Criminal Court Treaty is also accompanied by a huge loophole, which is to say, if the president declares that it's in the U.S. national interest to continue providing military assistance to that ratifier of the ICC treaty, the aid can go forward anyhow. So this is a lot of smoke and mirrors. It's designed to try to scare other governments into not ratifying the court on the hope that they just don't read the language too closely.
Is the U.S. also signing bilateral agreements with countries, one after another, to get them to extradite anyone that could possibly be held or is told to extradite someone to The Hague?
Yeah, well, that's the latest act by the Bush administration. You'll recall that last May, President Bush took the very unusual step of unsigning President Clinton's signature on the International Criminal Court Treaty. Then in June and July, the U.S. basically threatened U.N. peacekeeping around the world unless an exemption was given to Americans who might participate in peacekeeping efforts. And that was partially won by the Bush administration, although the worst efforts on its part were fortunately blocked by the Security Council. Now what the administration is doing is running around the world and trying to strong-arm governments to sign agreements with it that should an American soldier be on the territory so far of Romania or Israel, the two countries that have signed these treaties, those governments vow not to turn the U.S. soldier over to The Hague for prosecution by the International Criminal Court. Now, in principle, these kind of agreements are actually recognized by the ICC treaty, but they were recognized on the assumption that governments entering into them would be cooperating with the court. And it was seen more as a routing mechanism because the court gives preference to national prosecutions. That is, if an American is wanted by the court, the U.S. government gets the first crack at investigating and prosecuting the soldier. And it's only if there's a failure of justice in the United States that the ICC would take over. These agreements are really a perversion of what was originally contemplated by the treaty, because the U.S. is trying to enter into these agreements not to simply route for an orderly routing mechanism for soldiers ultimately to be brought before the court, but rather as a way of avoiding the court's jurisdiction altogether, because the U.S. has vowed not to cooperate with the court in any respect.
Finally, where does the court stand today with, tremendous opposition from the U.S. behind the scenes for quite a while now, but now it has been established?
Yeah, well, the good news is that the court has jurisdiction as of July 1st. There are, as of today, 77 governments that have ratified. Just yesterday, Colombia ratified, and that's a terribly important ratification because most observers of the court believe that the first case is likely to come either out of Colombia or out of Congo, two of the ratifiers where there are very serious war crimes being committed and where the local government has not shown the capacity or the willingness to pursue those war criminals itself.
Ken Roth is Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You are listening to Democracy Now! We're going to go to our break early. When we come back, we're going to turn to a speech recently given in Lawrence, Kansas, by Bruce Ellison, who is one of the lead attorneys for Leonard Peltier. This is a number of interesting efforts are underway in Washington, among them a bipartisan effort to strip the FBI building of its name, the J. Edgar Hoover Building. You're listening to Democracy Now!, back in a minute.
Thank you.
Canoes upstream, Ry Cooter, here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. A bipartisan group from the House Government Reform Committee recently proposed legislation that would strip the name of J. Edgar Hoover from the FBI headquarters building in Washington. As evidence mounts that Hoover systematically violated the law in the conduct of FBI investigations. The lawmakers, including Republican Dan Burton of Indiana, Democrat John Tierney of Massachusetts, cites the case of James Salvati, who, along with three others, were sentenced to life in prison for a 1965 mafia-related murder in Boston that the FBI knew they did not commit. Exposure of similar cases of FBI misconduct have led to the release from prison of such people as Black Panther Party members Geronimo Jijaga Pratt, Daruba Bin Wahad. Another focus of the FBI's COINTELPRO activities was the American Indian Movement, or AIM. The FBI's efforts against AIM culminated in the June 26, 1975 shootout at Oglala on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Archbishop Desmond Tutu says he should be freed. Amnesty International calls him a political prisoner. Amnesty and the U.S. Committee on Civil Rights have called for a congressional investigation into his case. The FBI says he's a cold-blooded murderer. I'm talking about Native American leader Leonard Peltier. Peltier is serving two life sentences for the fatal shooting of two FBI agents he says he did not kill. He's been in jail for nearly 26 years. Next month, he'll turn 58. Two medical doctors have determined he's receiving suboptimal care in prison for a series of chronic conditions, including hypertension. He's partially blind in one eye. Last month, Leonard Peltier was denied parole from the U.S. Penitentiary at Leavenworth again. He's been denied parole at least five times. In April, the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee filed a civil suit against the FBI for its political, media, and lobbying efforts they say have thwarted Peltier's due process to obtain a fair hearing. His defense committee claims the U.S. government falsified evidence leading to his arrest and coerced false testimony or hid exonerating evidence to obtain his conviction. This June, the defense committee obtained 30,000 pages of classified documents through the Freedom of Information Act. The FBI says the documents are the full extent of the FBI's so-called RESMERS file, which stands for Reservation Murders. Today, we're going to go to a talk that Peltier's lawyer, Bruce Ellison, gave in Lawrence, Kansas, a couple of weeks ago. Bruce Ellison was co-counsel during Leonard Peltier's trial in 1977 and has represented him ever since. He's researched, studied, and documented the FBI's involvement on Pine Ridge and the FBI's activities in the American Indian Movement. Perhaps more than any other, Bruce Ellison has an encyclopedic command of the facts and history of the Peltier case and of the scores of AIM members and Lakota traditionalists whose murders have gone uninvestigated. This is Bruce Ellison.
Good evening. It's a great honor to be here and visit with you today for a while, as long as you'll tolerate me. And as Michael said, when we're done, we'd sure like to entertain any questions that you might have. I think it's important in understanding Leonard Peltier's case, we first look at what's going on today. Our government says that in the name of terrorism, we must give up our rights. We must allow for the FBI and other intelligence agencies to come into our homes, listen to our phones, read our email, something I'm still trying to learn how to write, that we should give up due process. We should not allow for the Constitution to interfere with the prosecution of people that our government says is terrorist. And I say this because in order to really understand Leonard Peltier's case and the reason why he's still in prison, the reason why the FBI does not want to allow for justice for him, certainly not a new trial, which if he was to get, the government knows it could not win, why it does not want congressional investigation into FBI operations on Pine Ridge and the prosecution of Leonard Peltier, is because it would expose that so much of what our government says we should accept now, they have been working on for decades, waiting for the right opportunity to impose not just on the indigenous people in South Dakota and other places in the Midwest, on the black and brown communities in both rural and urban areas, but on the general population. We hear lots of talk today about domestic security and homeland security and whatnot, but let's talk about domestic security. Back in the early 70s, the general population was being encouraged to understand that there were threats to national security. There was the Black Liberation Movement, the Brown Liberation Movement, there was the American Indian Movement. The FBI in its own documents characterized the American Indian Movement, which was formulated in the late 60s, early 70s, as a human and civil rights organization, seeking such subversive things as equal job opportunities, equal housing opportunities, decent medical care, decent educational opportunities, justice, the end of land thefts, honoring of treaties, of which, you know, one of the things, if one studies the history of the United States, the history of the United States really has always been about land and resources. And the problem was it was these people who were here who were in the way. So they had to be called savages, or there were references in the homesteading to the land being barren. And for in the area where I now am happy to call my home, and I live in the Black Hills. It's not only the spiritual center of the Lakota and the Arapaho and the Northern Cheyenne and other peoples, but what we, what Custer found in 1874 was that there's a lot of gold in the Black Hills. A number of years before that, in 1868, after defeating the United States military, the United States military sued for peace and formulated what became known as the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. But as soon as gold was discovered, instead of the Army keeping settlers and others out of what were referred to as Indian country, in fact, the Army kept people from worshiping in the Black Hills and began trying to destroy the different nations that existed in the area, including the Lakota Nation. The Lakota Nation used to consist of half of South Dakota and half of Wyoming and parts of Montana and North Dakota and Colorado and Nebraska. Now it's restricted to tiny reservations in mostly South Dakota. 100 years later, though, as the American Indian Movement was talking about treaty rights, some 27 multinational corporations came into the Black Hills region and basically staked claim or leases for the entire geographical area for gold, for silver, for iron ore, for oil, for coal, for uranium. It was again about land and resources. The FBI became very upset at the American Indian Movement, as with the other movements that were going on during that time period in the cities, because they knew that what was being asserted as being wrong was in fact the truth. And for some reason in our democracy, the truth is something that our government and our corporate leaders have always been afraid of. For the American Indian Movement, what it meant was, first, the things that may sound familiar to you: surveillance, infiltration, and what eventually became disruption. In 1972, there was a nationwide effort that focused in on Washington, D.C., and ended up with the occupation of the Bureau of Indian Affairs building in Washington. There was a lot of looking at the documents that were in the Bureau of Indian Affairs. One of the things that came out of that occupation was documentation which talked about how, with the cooperation of Indian Health Services, approximately one-third of the Indian female population between 18 and 25 years of age had been sterilized. generally without the knowledge or consent of the people who were involved. One of the people that was in that occupation was a man by the name of Leonard Peltier. Now, the occupation occurred approximately a week before the 1972 elections. And there was a, at that time, those of you that are around my age or older, remember that Richard Nixon was president. And he had this reelection committee that was called CREEP. I always loved that name. Committee to Reelect the President. Well, CREEP was very upset that in the right before this election campaign, there were a bunch of Indians in Washington, D.C. screaming about treaty rights and civil rights and human rights to this law and order president. And an amnesty was worked out. In fact, people were given bus fare, they were given gas, they were told there would be no prosecutions if they just left. There were rumors that started circulating immediately that about 32 people, though, had been targeted. Leonard Peltier went back home to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where he was working as an employment counselor for the Indian Center. And a few weeks after he got back, he was having a late night dinner in a restaurant with some friends when two people walked into the restaurant, sat down near him, and began obviously mocking and heckling him. And not wanting a confrontation, Leonard got up with his friends and they decided to leave. Well, Leonard was confronted by these two men outside. They turned out to be off-duty Milwaukee police officers. And a confrontation ensued. And Leonard was arrested. And he was beaten so badly by one of the officers that he couldn't use his hands for 3 days. They found a pistol in Leonard's pocket, which had a broken firing pin, didn't work. That's why Leonard was able to get it really cheap earlier that day. So they used that to charge Leonard with attempting to murder the police officer. And one of the officers actually received a citation for saving his partner's life. And before I heard this in the courtroom in 1978, I'd only seen it in the movies. That according to this officer, that as Leonard pulled the trigger and the hammer came down, he stuck his hand right in between it and managed to stop the gun from going off, this gun that didn't work, and saved his partner's life and received an award for that. Well, Leonard was charged with attempted murder of a police officer and then wounded knee happened. And he decided that he was not going to get a fair trial in Milwaukee and would be a better use to his people if he was elsewhere. The FBI intensified its operations around Wounded Knee. Wounded Knee was basically a protest to a corrupt tribal government on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. There was a man by the name of Dick Wilson there. And this protest was originally going to go to tribal headquarters, but the government supporting, you know, our government, and what I would suggest to you was reminiscent of what was going on in Southeast Asia and other parts of the world. The United States government was backing a tribal government. See, the people, the Lakota people had a chiefs and headsmen system of government. In 1934, the government imposed a tribal governmental system on basically every nation. This tribal governmental system was supposed to be modeled after our own, executive branch, legislative branch, and an executive branch. However, unlike our own, it had no system of checks and balances, and we know how well our system works that way. So it was a system that was designed to fail, but it was designed to replace the traditional governments. Well, on Pine Ridge, what that meant was a very despotic and corrupt administration under Dick Wilson. So in protest to this, people were going to march on the tribal buildings. Well, the FBI and the U.S. Marshal Service brought in to this tiny tribal community automatic weapons. They set up sandbag emplacements with heavy machine guns on the roofs of government buildings. They brought in sniper teams. They brought in nearly 100 men who were equipped for combat into the tribal administration. So in an effort to avoid confrontation, people went to the community of Wounded Knee. In 1890, many of you know, over 300 men, women, and children were massacred by the 7th Cavalry. In gullies and ravines, and so they went to that area to protest. Quickly, they were surrounded by armored personnel carriers. There was the use of the military flying phantom jets and all the typical trappings and of war were imposed on this tiny hamlet of Wounded Knee. And a 71-day siege took place. Now, one of the things that was going on right after Wounded Knee, because after 71 days, those people that were still left inside surrendered. There were two people that were killed. There were dozens of people that were wounded. Government documents showed some very interesting things. One, hundreds of thousands of rounds of ammunition were fired by government forces into this compound. The other thing that documents later showed was that during the occupation of Wounded Knee, the United States military, in conjunction with the FBI, was testing a secret plan for the suppression of dissent in this country by using military forces and providing forces like the FBI with military equipment, M16 assault rifles, armored personnel carriers, ammunition, intelligence information, aerial surveillance. And that was one of the things that later became exposed. But the government also was utilizing the criminal justice system. Hundreds and hundreds of people were arrested for participation or for support of Wounded Knee. You know, right now, if you are accused of being a funding source for some Middle Eastern group, whether it provides food for children in the morning, you are subject to have being closed down. You are subjected to being prosecuted. Well, the FBI went after funding sources. They went after people who wrote letters. They went after anyone. Because really what was going on 25 years ago was they were waiting for the excuse to impose this on the general population. So hundreds of people were arrested. And according to FBI documents, the government hoped that these prosecutions would destroy the American Indian movement and the support for it. According to FBI documents, about a year into this effort, the government decided that this was not working. So a couple of things happened. One was that the government intensified its disruption activities in the American Indian Movement. Another thing that happened was that it began arming and equipping a group on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation under the leadership of this corrupt tribal chairman, Dick Wilson, that called itself the Guardians of the Oglala Nation, the Goon Squad. And the Goon Squad set out to terrorize the mostly traditional community on the Pine Ridge Reservation, which supported the American Indian Movement. And during a 3-year period of time, out of a population of 11,000 people, nearly 60 men, women, and children were killed. And I'd like to describe for you briefly what it was like at that time period. We're talking about that if you were a member or a friend of a member of the American Indian Movement, or if you lived in a community that generally supported the American Indian Movement, out of 9 districts, 7 were considered to be heavy supporters of the American Indian Movement. You could be, if you stood outside your home, you could be killed by a sniper, because people were. When you went to sleep at night, which you never knew, was whether sometime during the middle of the night, 10, 15, 20 carloads of Goon Squad members would come through your community and fire automatic and semi-automatic weapons rounds through the walls of your home. It was like going to sleep at night. The parents or the grandparents would gather the children and put them in the center of the houses so that hopefully there would be enough walls between the outside and that location that people would not be shot and killed, but they were. If you were walking to your friend's house at the wrong time of the day or the wrong time of night as goons went by, if you're a man, you might be ganged and beaten. If you're a woman, you might be gang raped. And the Wounded Knee Defense Committee documented many of these incidents over the course of that 3-year time period, something we've been asking Congress to look at. It's very clear that the FBI, which claimed exclusive federal criminal jurisdiction on the Indian reservations and responsibility for federal crimes such as murder, assault with a dangerous weapon, rape, was on the side of the goons. They allowed these things to happen. As a federal judge, federal appellate judge, Judge Heaney, who's looked at probably more evidence than any other federal judge about this, concluded, was that, in his words, in a letter to the first Bush, recommending executive clemency for Leonard Peltier, said that instead of responding to the legitimate grievances of Indian people during the Wounded Knee, the government instead responded with military force, which in fact led to this firefight on June 26, 1975, in which two FBI agents and a young Indian man were killed. A jury which heard the evidence which acquitted two of Leonard Peltier's co-defendants, Darrell Butler and Bob Roberto, concluded that the FBI was responsible for the climate of fear and terror which existed on the reservation. I would suggest to you that it is not too strong a conclusion, and which full and open congressional hearings, subpoenaing people, subpoenaing documents would prove, is that the FBI actually sponsored terrorism within the United States in order to suppress a political movement, the American Indian Movement. 2 months before the firefight, the FBI was engaged in a nationwide search for Leonard Peltier. They were using what they called their extremists and their security informants to try and find him. They noted in these documents that every time there was an AIM action anywhere in the country, Leonard Peltier seemed to be there and was involved. Now, just like today, and what concerns me today, as a criminal lawyer, as a father, and as someone who grew up believing that we were a country that of freedom and democracy, was what this portends, what happened then, what it portends for us now. 2 months before the firefight, the FBI issued a position paper, the likes of which I have never seen in any other government document for within the United States. It was called FBI Paramilitary Operations in Indian Country, and it was how the FBI was going to use paramilitary forces and U.S. military equipment to suppress the American Indian Movement, how it was going to use the White House to deflect criticism of military operations to suppress First Amendment activities within the United States. And a month later, the FBI began a massive buildup on Pine Ridge. And it brought in mostly SWAT team members from around the country. One of those people that it brought in was a SWAT team member out of Denver, Jack Kohler, who was killed on June 26, 1975.
Bruce Ellison, the lead attorney for Leonard Peltier. We're going to continue with his speech in just a minute. And by the way, if you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Back in a minute.
Throw him in jail and they kept him there, hoping soon he'd die. That his body and spirit would waste away, and soon after that his mind. But every day he's born a fool, one who thinks that he can rule, one who says tomorrow's mine, one who wakes one day to find prison doors open, the shackles broken, and chaos in the street. Everybody singing free, 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 free. Everybody singing free, 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 free. Everybody singing free, 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 free.
Tracy Chapman, Freedom Now. Here on Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman, has returned to the speech of Bruce Ellison given several weeks ago in Lawrence, Kansas. Bruce Ellison, attorney for indigenous rights activist Leonard Peltier at Leavenworth.
The FBI had massive invasion of the Pine Ridge Reservation within hours of this firefight. Within hours of this firefight starting, there were SWAT teams that were landing from as far away as Quantico, Virginia. They had surrounded the area, and everybody vanished. FBI documents say that as many as 47 people were involved in the confrontation with them that day. 47. That's a very interesting number. Many, many people, according to FBI documents, were identified as being involved in that firefight with them. And when it was all over, three people were dead. 2.5 weeks later, according to FBI documents, at the Rapid City office was reporting how the investigation was proceeding. One of the items was that the FBI was trying to link up evidence with suspects. Well, that's a very logical investigative technique. The next item, though, however, was different. According to that line on this FBI teletype at headquarters, the FBI was going to develop information to lock Leonard Peltier into the case. Well, what does develop information mean? The other thing that's very important, I would suggest, not only for Leonard Peltier, but for us as people in this within the borders of the United States, is this. One of the things that we're told today is that in order to protect us and keep us safe, we have to merge the intelligence and criminal investigative abilities and forces of the FBI and other agencies, because we'll be safer. Our democracy will be protected. Within hours of this firefight starting, FBI headquarters in 1975 transferred the criminal investigation of the deaths of the agents away from the Special Agent in Charge Minneapolis Division, who's normally in charge under the scheme the FBI set up, and put the command and operational control under the auspices of the domestic security chief of the FBI, a man by the name of Richard Held. So what that meant was the investigation of the deaths of these two FBI agents, the criminal investigation, became part of an ongoing domestic security operation against the American Indian Movement. So when the FBI started talking 2.5 weeks later of developing information to lock Leonard Peltier into this case, they were talking about what we're talking about today. Government brands you as a terrorist. The government says you are subjected to a domestic security investigation. Then all holds are off. They can do anything they want. For the case of Leonard Peltier, it meant fabricating ballistics evidence. It meant suppressing proof of that fabrication. It meant suppressing evidence that the agents chased in a red pickup instead of a red van, which they presented to the jury. It meant creating a climate of fear and terror within the courtroom that was a very frightening place to be. Those jurors were absolutely terrified. And they were encouraged to be terrified of Leonard Peltier and his friends and his family that had come to support him. And I'll give you an example of how this terrorism occurred. The previous summer, two co-defendants had been found not guilty on self-defense grounds. The government had prosecuted them on the theory that they participated in the firefight. And by the way, the evidence was they and Leonard Peltier, acting together, participated in the firefight. And the jury, having reached the conclusion that the FBI was responsible for the climate of fear and terror on the Pine Ridge Reservation, which precipitated that firefight, said self-defense. And the government decided that it wanted to figure out why these acquittals had occurred. They blamed it on the judge. The judge allowed in all this evidence about the climate of fear and terror on the reservation, about the goon squad, about how the FBI just stood back and watched these things happen. And do you have time, do you have the patience for me to tell you a couple of stories about some of that? Do you? I'll give you an example. In the early part of 1976, Dick Wilson lost the election on Pine Ridge. He lost it to a man by the name of Al Trimble, who had been the BIA superintendent. Al Trimble was from the community of Wambly. Numerous carloads of goon squad members entered the town of Wambly and took over two homes and fortified them. Throughout the day, they firebombed homes, they shot at homes. The BIA sent a SWAT team in. FBI came in, they said, we can't do anything, we're not a protective force, we just investigate crimes. BIA SWAT team came in and started disarming the community and would go out of its way to make sure it didn't go anywhere near the homes where the goon squad members were. Well, there's a man by the name of Guy Dullknife, a young man, early 20s. He and his wife and their baby drove into their driveway. And three goons from behind a car parked across the street fired high-powered rifle rounds through the back window of their car. and they ran into the house, and Guy had a single-shot 22 rifle, which he returned some fire. The BIA SWAT team came in, disarmed Guy, and arrested him for disorderly conduct, and made no effort to go after the Goon Squad members that had fired semi-automatic weapons at the house. Guy had a friend by the name of Byron DeSursa. Byron DeSursa's father ran an underground anti-Dick Wilson newspaper on the Pine Ridge Reservation. He was an AIM member. He was also did some work with the Wounded Knee Defense Committee. Guy's family called, and Byron went to Wombly to find out what was going on. About a quarter of a mile from Wombly, he and three friends, they were traveling a car, Byron was driving the car. A caravan of Goon Squad members, additional Goon Squad members, came and passed them, opened fire on the car, and a bullet went through the door and mushroomed and hit Byron DeSursa, and even though he was a quarter of a mile from an aid station, he bled to death. FBI didn't come in and do much about that either. And I was asked to come in and investigate that murder by the tribal chairman Lecht, and I went down there. And so I got to see some of this stuff. And I saw how the SWAT team stayed away from the houses where the Goon Squad members were. I saw the bullet-riddled houses. Right before I went down there, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I had a phone conversation with a resident of the Wombly community. While we were on the phone, somebody fired an automatic weapon at the house. And I could hear the weapon discharging. I could hear the rounds hitting the house. And of course, the phone hitting the floor as the man I was talking to did the same. And we got there, and the tribal chiefs and headsmen held a meeting that night. Because they could not get any law enforcement protection, they called upon AIM to come in and gave the goons until noon the following day to leave. And at about 11:30 in the morning, the SWAT team suddenly shows up, goes to the Goon Squad houses. The FBI suddenly shows up and is milling around the front of that house. And then the Goon Squad members exit the house carrying their automatic and semi-automatic weapons, get into their cars, and get an escort out of town. One of the people who was in the car when the assassination, and it was an assassination of Byron DeSursa, took place, was given a deal. In return for testifying that his fellow Goon Squad members, including Dick Wilson's son and another Goon Squad leader, fired in self-defense on a car that had no weapons, he was given a deal that he would plead guilty to manslaughter and get a 5-year prison sentence, which under the federal system many do about a year and a third. That's what it was like to live on Pine Ridge. That was what it was like when the FBI says that they're fighting terrorism. We've gotten some documents recently that talk about domestic security operations. One of the things these documents talk about is how when Leonard's trial was about to start, the FBI specifically continued what they referred to as a full domestic security investigation, specifically because Leonard's trial was about to start. The FBI has always said this was a regular criminal case. There was nothing political about it. When we were doing debates with the FBI 2 years ago, for the first time they were willing to debate, the assistant special agent in charge of the Minneapolis division on South Dakota Public Radio said that there was never a domestic security operation against AIM, and there was no documentation to prove it. Well, we've got that proof. It literally says domestic security investigation. And what it also talks about is, it talks about how AIM, one of the reasons why they want to continue stuff, and this goes over several continuations of the what they called it, full domestic security investigation, was that they felt that AIM was using or threatening to use force to influence the government. If you haven't done so already, go read the U.S. Patriot Act. It says that if you use or threaten to use force with the idea of influencing the government in any way, now this can be a sit-down demonstration on a street, but that's the language. The government says you're using or threatening to use force to influence the government, state government, federal government, you are violating the U.S. Patriot Act. You are a terrorist. And as we know from this minor gangbanger in Chicago, even if you're a U.S. citizen, you may get hauled away, I would suggest, to a military camp for interrogation. So Leonard Peltier was on trial. One of the things that the jury, the FBI concluded when the acquittals of Butler and Robidoux was that the jury was able to go home at night. They were able to go home, hug their babies, hug their spouse, see their friends, watch the news. It caused most of the people in a conservative white community in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to believe that the acquittals were just and appropriate. So when Leonard Peltier gets extradited to the United States on affidavits that the government has admitted were false, eyewitness affidavits were false. Under American law, it doesn't matter whether the government kidnaps you and brings you back. Once they got you here, they can prosecute you. That law has been in existence since the Supreme Court decided that not too long after the turn of the last century. So one of the things that they got the judge to do is, see, they went to the judge right away. According to FBI documents, they held a number of meetings alone with the judge to convince him that Leonard Peltier was a terrorist. His courtroom was in danger. He had to have heavy security in the courtroom. That even the defense team was trying to bug his chambers and bug the jury room and was monitoring FBI stuff. We were looking at some stuff today that had people crawling in walls and stuff because they were trying to figure out. We only wish we had that capability to do that stuff. But they convinced him that he had to sequester the jury. So I went and I watched one time because I was hearing stories. See, every day the jury would go from the hotel to the courtroom, hear the morning court, go back to the hotel for lunch, and then come back after lunch, go to court, and then come back at the end of the day. So I watched one time at noon. Court ends. A school bus pulls up to the back of the courthouse. All the windows are taped up, supposedly so that no snipers start shooting at the jurors. It's pulled up to within about 10 feet of the door. Suddenly the door bursts open and a team of marshals come and surround the bus quickly. And they're looking as though there's an armed assault that's about to take place. There are sniper teams very visible on the roof. An all clear sign is given and the jurors are literally pushed out the door of the courthouse and onto the bus. Whereas if they were even to take an extra breath, they would be killed. You can't do this 4 times a day, 5 days a week, for 6.5 weeks of trial and not terrify people. And we know, as we're being told every day, that if we're afraid, we should not think, and we should just look to the FBI and other agencies for our protection. Well, one of the things that those guys take an oath when they raise their hands and they get their little badges is that they will defend and uphold the Constitution of the United States. That's as important, supposed to be, to them as investigating and prosecuting any alleged violations of law. But you can't create a climate of fear and terror in a courtroom and say you're talking about justice. So Leonard Peltier was convicted. We were told the 2,500 pages of documents that we got was at the trial was all there was. And as Michael talked a little bit about, we did a Freedom of Information Act request about 20-some-odd years ago, John Privitera primarily. And we found 2 things in those documents. One was the FBI fabricated the evidence because their theory at trial was that Leonard Peltier personally shot and killed the agents. The second thing was the fact that the government was planning, in fact, paramilitary assaults on that particular area within the weeks and months before that firefight. The Court of Appeals said, see, the legal standard was at that time from the U.S. Supreme Court that if the government suppresses evidence that goes to the heart of the case against you, the key evidence, and casts a doubt, that's the Supreme Court's language, casts a doubt on that evidence, you get a new trial. The 8th Circuit Court of Appeals, looking at the suppressed ballistics evidence alone, said that that evidence not cast a doubt, but cast a strong doubt on the government's case, and somehow that was not legally enough. As a criminal defense lawyer, as a lawyer, I am embarrassed by the outrageous excuse that the courts gave in not granting a new trial. By the Supreme Court's own standards, they should have. So it was a political decision. Judge Heaney was so upset, wrote that opinion. I mentioned his name before. Not only did he feel the FBI was at least equally responsible for what happened that day, and they've never been prosecuted or even investigated. But that he recommended clemency, executive clemency for Leonard Peltier. Now, we now know, as Michael mentioned, that somewhere between 60 and 100,000 pages of documents, of which we've now gotten a little bit more. So hopefully we'll find something that will give us the ability to try and get a new trial for a man that they know they can't go to trial against. They know they could not convict him. And I would suggest that as a trial lawyer, we'll go to any jurisdiction they want in this country. Let us put on a full defense, and they will not be able to convict Leonard Peltier. They will conclude, the jury will conclude, like the jury in Cedar Rapids. They were terrified by the end of the Butler Robbery trial. From interviews that those jurors gave and the jury foreman gave, they were terrified not of Daryl Butler and Bob Robidoux, not of the AIM members in the courtroom. They were terrified that the government was going to get so upset with them. In contrast to the jury in Leonard's case, where by the time the trial ended, the jurors were so terrified, they were afraid. They were encouraged to believe that any night some AIM people were going to come and go and get them, which was, of course, ridiculous. So to me, the Leonard Peltier case really is all about us as a country. It's really all about the kind of system that we're going to have in the future, as well as today. It's going to be whether we're going to simply accept giving agencies like the FBI more authority and more abilities to violate our rights simply because the government doesn't like what we have to say. And these joint terrorism task forces that are being set up, they're told to investigate people who raise environmental concerns, people who oppose corporate activities in a local jurisdiction, people who question state governments, people who question both domestic and foreign policies of our government. So what Leonard Peltier represents is not only a perfect documentation of how far that can go, because what Leonard Peltier's case, I would suggest, represents it is that if the government targets you because of your political activities and fabricates a case against you and then suppresses the proof of that fabrication, that even if you get that proof, you still cannot get out of jail maybe for the rest of your life. And what kind of a country do we have about that if we're in that situation? So I thank you for your patience.
Bruce Ellison, one of Leonard Peltier's attorneys. Peltier is serving two life sentences at Leavenworth Prison. Ellison was in Lawrence, Kansas last week, going through 11 boxes of recently declassified FBI documents in the Peltier case. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Jeremy Scahill. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro, but as he recovers, Miranda is engineering today as well. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org, and you can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!